Hello everyone, I think we'll make a start. Just heard the bell go outside. My name's Jeff Warner from Australian Super, and I'm the chair for the session this afternoon with our two presenters, Michael Rice and Alan Stevens from Rice Warner. Former colleagues of mine, and I know the stuff that they've got to present to you is really good stuff. I've seen some of it before. Just need to get through some housekeeping before we start. This session will run for 50 minutes. There'll be a bell go 5 minutes before the end, and I'm going to try and wrap it up pretty quickly because I've got to get to another one where I'm chairing. A rushed afternoon for me. But what we'll do is we'll have Michael and Alan will get up and present for about 20, 30 minutes. They're happy to take questions as they go, and once they're finished, we'll have a Q&A anyway. There's a microphone in the middle. If you've got questions, please go to the microphone and state your name if you could. I'm also supposed to remind you about the presenter feedback. I'm sure you've heard that wherever you've been going. Hopefully you've got Summit Connect on your iPhone or tablet. And I think that's it. So without further ado, let me introduce the two speakers. First of all, Michael Rice, and Michael probably needs no introduction to any of you. He has extensive experience in the financial services industry, both in Australia and overseas. He specialises in providing strategic advice to financial institutions, fund managers, government agencies, industry associations, and large superannuation funds. And Michael founded the firm Rice Warner in December 1987. Michael has also undertaken pioneering research into age pension dependency and trends. He has a keen interest in the integration of social security and superannuation, as well as measuring the adequacy of retirement incomes for current fund members. He heads up Rice Warner's public policy work and provides detailed submissions on most relevant government inquiries and pending legislation. And that's Michael. I'll introduce Alan now because I think they're going to dovetail off each other. Alan has over 30 years' experience in financial services in Australia and overseas, both in senior management roles and as a consultant. He has extensive experience in wholesale and retail markets and has managed and provided advice on product design, pricing, related systems development, market, advertising and distribution, both direct and via advisors. He has also had significant involvement in developing and implementing corporate strategy, including restructurings, mergers and acquisitions. I give you Michael and Alan.
Thank you, Jeff. He always says kind words because he wants to keep getting his royalty for the use of his name. So I'm going to give you a non-technical introduction, and then Alan's going to show you some really complex slides. But they are interesting, but they're very actuarial, which is appropriate for this Congress. So firstly, I'd like to say retirement today is driven by tax, not by people's needs. And that causes all sorts of problems, and it means that the system is inequitable, it's unfair in many places, it needs change, but governments find it very difficult to make those changes. Costello, when he had a massive surplus, was able to give a lot of money away. Now that we have a deficit, we're finding it very hard to get it back again. And so we know that the system needs change, and that makes it very difficult to plan for, 30 or 40 years in retirement, given that if we look at something with a static set of rules, we might find those rules change over time and put us at risk. So the things we know are that the Treasury's estimate of super concessions are $32 billion, they admit that's probably inflated, but after the tax-free family home, it's still the biggest concession in the tax system. And most of those concessions go to the well-off, so they're not very well targeted, and I say that even though I'm a beneficiary, and most of the people in this room will be as well. We also know that 75% of retirees are on welfare. They get a full or part age pension. And that's $41 billion, going up to $50 billion in 4 years. Again, the biggest payment out of the system for the use of our taxes. And although the intergenerational report shows that this will improve in time, it, The number of people in 40 years' time getting a pension is still about 75%. It's just that more of them will be part pensioners rather than full pensioners. Or if the government keeps changing means testing, that might change as well. The uncertainty is really difficult for super funds and retirees, and in our opinion, most are too conservative in their investment strategies, partly as a result of this uncertainty, and the people are frugal because they're scared of running out of their money. Are we not? All right. Yeah. All right. Push that. Thank you, Al. Do this one.
There we go.
Okay. Now, so individuals facing retirement have a lot of problems. There's not a lot of mortality pooling in Australia, as Alan will talk about. So that they have to decide how to use their money, and the majority do actually leave it in the system. About 85% of money stays in the superannuation system. Quite a lot goes out as lump sums, but a third or more of that is reinvested in bank term deposits as well. So people don't blow their money, but they basically leave it in account-based pensions for the most part. And the challenge they have is they don't know how much to draw. They obviously, on a population of one or two, if you're a family, you don't know when you're going to die, and you can't predict how long your money should last. So if you're frugal and you let it dribble out and you just live off the income, you'll leave a large bequest, so the money will go out of the system. Some people argue, therefore, tax concessions have been paid unreasonably. But if you spend too much, you'll end up on welfare earlier than you should. So this balance is really tricky. And obviously, if everybody was in a lifetime annuity, if the whole population was, then you would get that balance. But we've got problems with annuities in a voluntary system in that people don't buy them for a number of reasons. Tony's here from Challenger. He can tell you what some of those reasons are for planners and consumers alike. And the problem is that the lack of pooling means that money is generally spent inefficiently. And Alan will come to some of the possible solutions and about some of the challenges we face in trying to get those communicated to the public. The other thing I'd say before I hand to Alan is that 70% of people at retirement are part of a married couple. So most of the work we do on benefit projections is based on individuals. So by definition, the majority are incorrect. And this is a real issue. I think as an industry, we need to try and get families together. Now, that happens in an SMSF, and it also happens if people use a financial planner. But for middle Australia, they're really sitting on their own, and the projections are not really very useful to them. And I say this in the background of the Financial System Inquiry, which recommended a CIPA, Comprehensive Income Product in Retirement, yet another acronym we've got to learn, and that was to have effectively a default mechanism, if you like, a My Pension product for people. And the difficulty with that is that how do you give a default if it's got, for example, inflexible guarantees or pooling that people don't understand? And I hope Alan will give you some of the themes that might help super funds and individuals and perhaps planners think about what needs to be taken into account if they were to establish such a default. Over to you.
Now you've had Dad, now you've got Dave. So, we won't talk about Jeff. Now, the problem in dealing with retirement is this whole planning exercise. What do you do with your money? What does the person do with their money? And there's a whole range of priorities that come up. One of those is, how much income do I get? How long does the income last? But also, classically, people say, well, I want to have some money as a bequest. So there's a nest egg. How much do I keep in a nest egg? What's the bequest amount? And it's a classic reason given. I mean, I used to sell a lot of annuities years ago, but people didn't like non-return annuities because what happens if I die next week? The probability of that happening was 2/3 or 5/8 of almost nothing, but nonetheless, that's what they worried about. So what we've sought to do is to just look at the lifetime. So take all the cohort of people retiring at age 65 and put them through the actuarial projection and watch them die off as they go through to age 110. Certain percentage die each year. Of course, at the point they die, they will have received a certain income and they will get a certain amount of capital back. So what's the total value? What's the lifetime value to the cohort of particular product choices? So that's really what we're going to do. We've picked a simple model because to some extent the idea here is to understand the internals of that, the interaction with the mortality and what's capital, what's income. If you start getting involved in lots of complexity on the other matters, then they tend to confound and confuse. So, simple model. We did have a look at the assumptions because right at the moment, obviously, things have been coming down over the last 6 months quite strongly. Although I was interested to note this morning that the long-term estimate on CPI was, Chris Caton had, was I think 2.6 or 2.8%, and the GDP, which is sort of the overall above that real rate, was 2.8. So I'm not sure they're too far out. Maybe they're a little bit higher overall, but even if you squeeze them down a little bit, doesn't change the overall picture particularly. So what have we done? How have we modelled this? We've just looked at the simple standard products that are out there. Account-based pensions and annuities, including the age pension. So what's the interaction with the age pension? Looked at immediate purchase of annuities or deferred purchase of annuities. This is not the purchase of a deferred annuity, it's the deferred purchase of an annuity. So you buy it a bit later in life. And we've looked at the standard sort of financial planning techniques that are done. They optimise the income to life expectancy. Well, I put 50%, so it's the median life expectancy as opposed to the average. And 75%. We've said retirement accounts 100, 250. I lost the 250 because it was just a whole lot of extra slides. And despite what Michael had to say, most everybody lives in retirement in couples. The modelling is for single males aged 65, and that's primarily because this is a point of interest much, much closer to Michael and my personal interests. But the real reason is, as soon as you start putting couples in, you get joint mortality, and the interaction of joint mortality with pension rules is an unbelievably complicated thing, and it's very, very difficult to see what's the complication related to joint life mortality and the pension rules and what's the actual underlying. So that's the reason, the real reason for picking 65-year-old males. So what I'm now going to do is just go through a range of scenarios as to what does the income look like from these various options, and then we'll have a look at how it, what's the value. So the first one is just the standard. So the heading's $500,000, 50% life expectancy, and it's an account-based pension. So easy to follow. And if you optimise the income, these are real income, so deflated for wages. You can generate that type of level of income with the single age pension coming up underneath. And as you can see, the age pension is very close to the ask for modest standard. So what do we then do? There's other choices. Well, what we can do is by put some of it in the annuity, in the account-based pension, and use some of it to buy an annuity. So put it in context without any adverts. It's the best price annuity out there. 25% to it. It repays capital over the first 15 years. to see the difference, you can see the easiest way you can see that, you can see there's a slight reduction in the early duration income, but the income then extends out over the full period. The annuity is CPI'd, the deflator is wages, so it does lose a little bit of value over time. So that's the with the capital return. You can also buy these annuities without a capital return. So we have a look at that, and the easy thing you can see there is obviously the income goes up a little bit as you move to without capital return. And finally, the other choice we wanted to look at was if we were to, in fact, not buy the annuity at the front, but wait until close to the life expectancy. So you use the annuity to replace the income for those people who get to life expectancy. Obviously, they don't make it. They don't buy the annuity. They just take the capital. And again, that pushes up the longer-term income even more with a small reduction up to life expectancy. So that's the one standard set of the use of account-based pensions. If you just purchase the annuity, it was just a full annuity purchase, it looks sort of like that. So that's where your income would be if you just bought the annuity, and that's an annuity with a capital return. So these are all the options that are faced by people now, figuring out how they're going to invest their money, how they're going to draw their money, how they're going to spend their money. The other one that gets used, I'm just starting with this one again, it's the same one that we had before, just to give the starting point, is to actually try and optimise this out over a longer period. So you take less money at the front and let the money last a bit longer. And the classic financial planning scenario is to go to the 75th percentile. And that does that. So you get a drop down for the first part, but then it extends out for the extra 6 or 7 years that takes you out of the 75th percentile. And we can go through the same choices. So we add an annuity at the front, which actually, as you can see, does very little. To the it is a very small reduction to the early duration income for quite a big jump in the longer term income. And if you do it without a capital return, obviously you get slightly more income, but obviously you've got less access to capital in the early durations if someone should die. And finally, you can do it with a deferred purchase also. Exactly the same processes. So those are the classic financial planning type scenarios that are considered based around 50% life expectancy or the 75th percentile life expectancy, mix and match, account-based pension and annuities. So what is the value of these various choices? Let me just page through. So what we did was to take the income, obviously the income as they're earning it, certain people, they die after 2 years, they've had 2 years of income and they get their capital back. They die after 10 years, they've had 10 years income and they get what's left of their capital back. So we essentially take the cumulative real income, the capital return times the probability of dying in any 1 year, and then divide it by the starting balance. So you add that up over the whole period, you've killed off the whole cohort, each group of which has got a slightly different value, and you get the average. So that's what we've done as a ratio of the starting balance. So the comparisons. Those are the 9 choices that I've just been through with you. And the interesting thing about it is that, in fact, if you take the capital return, which is the red bit in the middle, so those that are holding up the capital more, they get, there's the people who die get more money back, so that's paid out to them. The green bit is the income generated from your own products, so your investment in either the account-based pension or the annuity or both. And the blue is what you get from the age pension, the interaction with the means test. So you find those that tend to hold up the asset value for longer, they get less back from the age pension, and there's that optimisation between I keep my capital, I lose my age pension, but I get longer-term income coming through. The interesting one that shows up with that is the one with the highest value is just the straight account-based pension at age 75, or also with the purchase of an annuity, very close to it. The thing, though, is what are we getting from the... if we look at it without the age pension. So what I've done, I've just got a slide here which I'm going to step through. This is essentially what I've just been talking about. This is so if you download the pack, you've actually got the comments about the graph. That I'm not going to spend too much time talking about it because we've done that. But if we take it without the age pension, so this is just then the intrinsic value of the product combinations, we get a slightly bigger variation. In this case, from the generation of income from the personal resources, the two options involving the deferred purchase of annuities give you the best value. And if you look at just the total income, so this is now you're saying, well, I'm not too fussed about the capital return, so I just want to go for what's the income, what's my best income return for these options. That's, again, the comments I've just been talking to. The total income return is actually very similar across all of them. If you take the combination of the age pension and the internally generated income, not fuss about the capital, they're saying that's what the kids are going to get, what is it that I get? There is actually not much to choose between them. There is obviously then need to make, which doesn't show up exactly in this because we're doing an average over everybody. Some people from a behavioural finance point of view will have a preference to early or late or middle or something like that, but I'm not trying to guess what those might be. Just look at the total values that we have. Any questions at this stage before I hop onto the smaller balances and the bigger balances? Copsmacked. Again, we're going over little differences, very closely followed. In fact, the lowest income item is from the annuity by itself. I'm now going to deal with what happens at the small end and what happens with much bigger amounts. I'm not going to go through all of those options. What I've picked out to demonstrate are the ones that are scoring better. But we go through the same thing. This is $100,000 people with quite small balances, optimised to life expectancy. You can see they're essentially getting the full age pension all the way, and there's a little bit on top of the full age pension, and that's what it looks like if you do it like that. Or you can actually improve your position quite a bit doing the deferred purchase annuity. That's the 25th one. You can spread your income out to 75 percentile. Again, that reduces it a little bit, but actually improves your overall income. And you can also do that by adding an annuity at the end to extend it out for the longer period. So you can see there's things that can be done in there. But if we compare these then to... what the overall lifetime value will be. Oh, sorry, there's the immediate annuity as well. I forgot about that one. Which it tops it up and you get a nice increase in your income over that period on top of the age pension. The comparison here is obviously dominated by the age pension because everybody in this period, with this amount of money, essentially gets a full age pension, which clearly tells you it's the predominant source of their income. Against the amount of money they had, and this shows you the value to the less wealthy of that age pension, you can see the overall they get a return of about six times what they started with in real terms. And that's obviously predominantly driven by the age pension. But again, small differences between them. You probably say with people with $100,000 sitting on top of the age pension, what they do with the $100,000 is not that critical as to their choices, because they underpinned, everything they do is underpinned by the age pension. There is a suggestion to some extent for people down this end, these are the people who should potentially go for a bit more growth and therefore a bit more volatility and therefore a bit more risk, because they really are subject to the put option of the age pension. I'm not actually going to go out and suggest to someone with $100,000 that they put it all in that wonderful property development down the back corner of Geelong, but a thought. If we then go to the... That's just a... We now look at the other end of the scale, which is people with $1 million. And I'll come back in a second, because clearly this is right in the area where the changes, the current proposed changes to the age pension means test do hit. This is on the rules as they currently stand. Optimising your return to life expectancy, $70,000 real income for that period, and then the age pension comes in and takes over at about the $28,000 thereafter.
Alan, this is based on the current proposals.
No, this is the current rules, not the current proposals. Yeah, current rules, not the current proposals. The current proposals, you probably remove the green bit prior to the life expectancy, and it then comes in once you've used up all your money, or very close to your life expectancy period. If you pop in the deferred buy, just to see, you can see there's a very small reduction in your early duration income for quite a big increase in your long duration income. So you can see that's probably going to be worth something. Similarly, if you move to the 75th percentile, you can see that does drop your early duration income quite a bit. And obviously you don't get that long term, but if you do a deferred purchase, you again get back to quite a good long-term income position versus the versus just the pure account-based pension. And if we purchase the annuity on that, we get that structure. Now, I just need to get to my comparisons. There we go. How do they compare? So it's the same comparison. Obviously the age pension in this case is not a particularly great value, but it is still there because of, with $1 million under the current rules, it's right in the messy spot of having to interact with the age pension. As you could get the drift from the way those previous couple of slides, targeting 50th percentile life expectancy with your drawdowns with deferred purchase gives you the best value out of this. But if we contemplate the new rules, then in fact we need to probably say, well, these people are not going to get the age pension for much of the time. So we probably should be looking at the situation without the age pension. And then, as we saw with the earlier slides, the two deferred purchase options do generate the best value from the products that you invest in and control yourself. I will just go over to... That's the comments I've just been making. And if we look at the summary of all of those options, with the very small and the very large, where you outside the interaction with the age pension, where you don't get that complex interaction with the age pension, just taking your money over the life expectancy or the deferred purchase version of it, the deferred purchase version to over 50% life expectancy or spreading it out to 75 give you the best value, because the age pension doesn't cause too much complication to the problem. In fact, strangely enough, if you have the complex interaction with the age pension and you want that overall value, so you're valuing the capital return and the income equally, because that's essentially what this approach does, then just the usual or the very simple financial planning methods work quite well. So that's the more complex place, which is where a lot of the financial planning activity takes place. Now, I want to move on to one other example. Now, to just look at those are my comments I was just saying. The value of the annuities, because as you can see in there, there's definitely a place we don't advocate you don't use annuities, because they definitely provide a value, particularly with the mortality pooling. But we've also looked at what value for money is returned by annuities, and that's looking at some of the intrinsic costs that go in the cost of capital, cost of reserving, etc., and to some extent how they're invested versus what you can do if you run it yourself. So what we've done here is to just look at a simple example again. Now, this is an account-based pension with a fairly diversified growth-orientated portfolio, so it's got a good slab of resource of infrastructure, direct property, so those illiquidity-type premium assets with equities. And it has I wouldn't say complex, but a fairly careful management of the cash flows from those investments so that you can minimise the risk of drawdowns in bad times. It's a version of account-based pension we've worked with a couple of our clients to try and implement. So what would happen if we just draw an income out of such an account-based pension with this careful management of cash flow, and we run it through stochastic model, our standard stochastic model, how long will the money last? So what we have here is, if I'm not sure you can see them all, the vertical lines are the ones we've had before. The 25th percentile is the first one here, but the 50th and 75th are the middle and end vertical line. And the lines of them are the percentile outcomes from the stochastic modelling. So the red one at the bottom is the 10th percentile, so 10% of the cases are worse than that. 90% are better than that. The green line is the 30th percentile, so that means 70% are better than that. And the dark blue line is the 50th percentile, so the median case out of the stochastic model, so 50% are better than that. But if you're looking at risk, this is the side of median you're more interested in, rather than the telephone numbers that get generated at the other end if everything's cream for 20 years. Wish it could happen. So what you see from this is essentially, if you invest that way, 50% or more of the scenarios will generate the same income as the annuity, and you get all your money back or more. 10% will still go to life expectancy. 90% will still go to life expectancy, and something like 70% get up to, close enough to age 100. This pretty close to lifetime for most people. But there is still obviously the risk down the bottom end. So don't discount that too much. But of course, the catch with this is, there is no mortality pooling here. This is just simply straight investment return. Whereas with the mortality pooling through an annuity or some other system, there's obviously profits from the mortality as well. So what I'm going to look at in the next one is to just consider a simple case. This is not an annuity, but a group self and annuitisation pool type concept, where approximately 25% of the money that the person has is at risk, so if they die, they lose it. And the result of that is that pool of money is essentially the premium, or the risk of that pool of money is the premium they pay to participate in the mortality pooling. Simple mortality pooling, all the people are the same age, we're looking at the same cohort of people. What would happen to that curve if we now... I'm talking, I might as well show you what it is. What would occur in the outcomes if we actually generate some profits, some mortality profits, by putting 25%? Obviously, people who die young, they lose their 25% and they don't hang around to age 100 to get the benefit of it, but the ones who live longer obviously get the money paid back into their accounts, which can then accumulate further and be used to draw down more. So if we do this one, this case, with a bit of mortality profit on 25%, then we get very similar results down the bottom end. They just move up a little bit. But that blue line hitting something at the 75th percentile, it's not the fact that it's hitting the 75th percentile. It cuts off there because it's hit the top boundary. It actually goes way up. So there's something like, you can see 60% of people will get their money back plus. And 10% of people will still, it's only pretty much close to life expectancy. 70% will do full life or better. The question then is, how do we get that sort of value put back into the products? Because at the moment, there's only one product out there that's along this line, and that's Mr. Knox's product, who's sitting over there smiling. But there's a lot of work going on in that area, but that's the sort of benefit you could get out of getting some mortality pooling onto the account-based pensions. And to get to the end very quickly, and then we can get ourselves grilled, investing in an account-based pension with the aim of converting some assets to annuities is the best option under the current product structures. And over time, if the self-annuitisation pools are developed more, the methods for people to share their mortality profits or to share their mortality exposure, it's probably the better way to put it, that would appear to be the optimal solution once we get to that point. So that's all I've got to say. Now, any questions?
Well, Alan, first let me say thank you to you and to Michael for a fascinating presentation. If anyone's got questions, as I said before, the microphone's in the middle, and please identify yourself when you come up to the microphone. So I'll start off. My name's Jeff Warner, and my question is, how much money do you think you need at retirement to live comfortably thereafter? And maybe you can even answer that question with the proposed changes to the assets means test. That'll put you on the spot.
The simple answer is more than I've got. And it doesn't matter how much I've got. I mean, I think you could see from that the sum of money that's for a single. With a couple, it's probably 1.5 times. Is that on, isn't it? You're probably up in that, if you want to operate, because you're moving into a situation where you don't have access to the age pension, you're probably looking at $1.5 million, something of that order, would be the number that comes out there. Any concept?
It's interesting that people on the age pension, a full age pension, still save on average. So I think what happens is people just adapt to however much they've got, because they have no choice, actually. And they just adapt their expenditure to the income that they have. I think we also are guilty as an industry of sometimes looking at high income people, like many of the people in this room, and thinking that we all need lots of money. But middle Australia doesn't get very much. If 20% of people live on the full age pension, $33,000 for a couple, the $100,000 that they get, if they can get an extra $3,000 or $4,000 a year on top of that, it's a 10% boost to their income. For them, it's probably quite a lot. For people in this room, everybody's sneering at the thought of living under $40,000 a year, but retired people, the majority of the population, have to do that.
Could you go to the microphone? Just to the microphone, thanks.
Sophie Ellsworth. I'm a journalist at the Herald Sun. Just the $1.5 million figure, is that singles?
No, when I was giving the comment, I was talking about a couple.
A couple, right. So just for the younger generations, there's this whole debate, you know, you should pay your home off before you put extra into super. What's your thoughts around that? And should people in their 30s, 40s be putting extra money into super now, or should they be focusing on things such as paying down their home, given that super keeps changing so much? There's a lot of uncertainty of what you'll end up with at the end.
Well, I give an answer based on my personal experience. How's that? I've always worked in an area where I had superannuation, so I wasn't like a lot of my generation in Australia who didn't really get into superannuation until, you know, into the 80s. But I was in a contributory scheme. The company put in 10%. I put in something else. And I was faced with exactly this thing. Do I increase my contributions? I did a simple calculation and said, what's the best rate of return on this extra money of mine? If I pay off my mortgage, and in those days we didn't have mortgages running at 6%, they were quite a lot more than that, then I'm going to get somewhere 10%, 11% after-tax rate of return. Would I get that sort of rate of return out of my super fund? At the time the answer was no. So I paid off the mortgage with the extra money. I mean, I kept up the basic contribution to get my super up so that I would, you know, be able to replace my income pretty much. But if I was looking at extra stuff at that stage of my life, it was putting it into the mortgage. And obviously, mortgage rates went further up. I then got put back into a financial institution with a highly subsidised interest rate, so I wasn't exposed to the problem, so the money went back into super. So I think people need to look at what the circumstances, where they're going to get the biggest payback. Personal answer.
Nicolette, oh, I think you've been beaten. Nicolette first, and then we'll go with the next question.
Thanks. That was a great paper, really interesting. Thank you. Just going back to your original assumptions, I just want you to talk through did you assume 7.5% return on the account-based pension, and was that post-fee, and how do you feel about that in a low-interest environment?
Well, that was a comment I made earlier on. It's at the adventurous end of where we are at the moment, but it's not a long way above. But what drives those comparisons is the relativities between the three assumptions. So to some extent, the margin between the wage inflation and the rate of return is the issue, and it's at 3.5, and it's possibly a bit high.
I'm assuming, though, for the annuity that you've modelled, you've used the current rates, though.
Yep.
Yeah, so do you sort of agree that there could be a mismatch there, potentially?
There is potentially some mismatch, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And that's why buying the annuities later in life, under this scenario, is based on an equity risk premium, saving quite a lot of money until you buy them. If in fact we have a low interest environment and people don't get the 7% returns over the next decade, well, the numbers will be different. But then every PDS will be subject to misleading conduct, because they all say that they're going to get CPI plus 3.5% or 4%, and there aren't any caveats in that I can see.
Hi, Mike Thornton from AMP. You touched on this very briefly at the beginning, but are you optimistic about the possibility of a MySuper retirement income product?
Well, I think everybody would desire one. If the dilemma is that the government, well, the FSI said that there should be one, and that there should also be some form of mortality pooling. If the pooling were to be guaranteed, such as an annuity, it would be quite difficult to make it a default, because the last thing you want is somebody 3 or 4 months after they've retired coming back and saying, I've seen a planner and this is really what I want to do, and they're locked into an inflexible contract. So I suspect when these contracts come out, they will probably be account-based pensions with a few options attached to them. And that there might be a recommended default, but people will have to sign up for it. And the fund will probably make them see a planner before they do.
I think the other thing is Treasury doesn't want products clicking over into the tax-free environment without deliberate decision by the client. They're a bit concerned that certain things will happen to their revenue.
Sorry, Tony, before you start, can I just be selfish, and unless anyone's got a burning question, make this the last one. I've heard the bell go, and I'm just conscious of getting people moving like myself. Okay, thanks, Tony.
Understood. So, Tony Boffinger. So I guess further to Nicolette's comment about the taking a model that and actually modelling two products and comparing it with an existing price on another product, I think one of the other mismatches in the analysis is you've assumed population mortality for the account-based pension and the GSA, whereas the annuity is based on a select set of lives. So the people who are buying the annuity are actually not going to get their alternative outcome is not the modelled alternative outcome because they are not experiencing population mortality.
It wasn't population mortality. It was a form of select mortality. So it was minus 5 years, minus... so it was... whatever the latest one is, 25% mortality improvement projected forward, and then there was a discount in the age and times 0.9.
So is that right? I thought you said it was ALT 2010, 2012 with 25-year mortality improvements.
Oh, sorry, that's a different model. Yes, you're right, that's the one that's in here. Yes, it's just at that level. So there's a, I do understand the annuities do have the other mortality in it, yes.
Okay, could I just please get you all to put your hands together and thank Michael and Alan for their presentation.